Hello, reanimated fans. I am H.A. Conrad, coming to you from Brooklyn. Here, as always, with my intrepid co-host, Stuart Tiffin. Hello, Stuart.
Yo, good morning.
Good morning. Today, we are talking about Deadlands, the TV show that came out just earlier this month, based upon a feature film, or sort of inspired by it, I believe. I have not watched the film, so I have to be a little, you know, vague about that, since I don't clearly know yet. But this is a series that was released on Shudder on Amazon, and we're going to go through and watch the whole thing. Today we're going to be recapping, reviewing episodes 1 and 2, but ahead of that we have just a couple of news items.
What's this director's thing you pulled up?
Oh, it's a listicle from Comic Book Resources, and it's just basically listing their sort of top horror directors. I think that there's some good ones on here, definitely. I was very happy to see that they, did you ever see Babadook?
Nah, know the name. I don't think I have, though.
Yeah, it's pretty creepy. And Jennifer Kent was listed on this, and it really is like a super, super creepy film, from 2014, and it was like, I admit that I kind of didn't make it through it because it freaked me out so much. So I was glad to see her on there. And then there's obvious, you know, there's like a few really well-known Japanese directors, and then the list rounds out with, and of course we've got, you know, some of the usual suspects. I was glad to see Jordan Peele on there. And you know, although I don't know if you and I have ever had this conversation, like Jordan Peele has like such a good way of setting up setting up the characters in the set, but he doesn't have a horror background, so it's kind of interesting what his interpretations of certain things are. But in any case, it's an interesting list. There's also some notable people missing from it. But I don't know, rounding out with Rob Zombie kind of cracks me up. And keep in mind, these are horror directors, not zombie film directors specifically. But I just thought it was an interesting thing. And there was a couple of directors I had never heard of on there, specifically a couple of the foreign directors that they put on. I think there was like an Argentinian director I had never heard of. I'm always willing to branch out. And there's so much stuff. There's so much content out there. That I think it's worthwhile. And it's also, as you and I have seen, like there's a very different feel to a film made by a director in like from various countries, just because there's like a specific tradition in how certain countries view these things. So like with the Italian director that the recommendation we watched a couple of, was it last time that we did that? No, two episodes ago.
It was a while back.
I just think it's interesting, that like there are different traditions, and it's kind of cool to see how those play out within those films. The Argentinian director, he did this, Gaspar Noé. Have you ever heard of him?
No, I honestly, this is not my forte. I haven't heard of most of these people. Jordan Peele, yes. Yeah. and Rob Zombie. But then I'm like, well, where are the other American directors? Either way, but go on.
Well, I mean, I think that's what I think they were trying to give, like, kind of a broad and give people like more sort of exposure to different film traditions and that kind of thing. So, like Ty West was in there, and I mean, you know, that's, you know, the Sacrament. Those are kind of things that, you know, he's a little bit more of like, his films definitely feel like almost like 70s and 80s horror, and they note that here. And that's sort of like what the like film like his editing and his filmmaking feel like that. Like they're a very specific tradition. And then also, you know, Hideo Nakata, you would know him obviously from The Ring.
But I never saw the Japanese Ring. I saw the American version. So like that sort of horror is not really my genre in a way. It's weird.
All right. Well, in any case, he's probably the most well-known in terms of like from an American's perspective, mainly because those got remade here. But anyway, throwing it on there, just if people want to see some new things, maybe they want to explore on the Netflix. And I believe quite a few of these are actually on Shudder. So, all right. Next up, Train to Busan news. What do you have to share?
This is a weird little story, but apparently in South Korea, where movie theaters are reopening, they are getting an extended release in July of Train to Busan. There's a trailer associated with this article, but I don't see anything in the trailer that I don't remember from the film. But I haven't rewatched it, basically, since we reviewed it. So watching that trailer also kind of made me nostalgic to rewatch Train to Busan. So if this extended version gets across the pond digitally or some other way, I would definitely be into sitting down and watching that. But it's an interesting kind of phenomenon that they're re-releasing this, obviously, to also drum up support for Peninsula, which is going to be the actual sequel to Train to Busan, coming out whenever. We've talked about that a couple times. There's more collateral being released, and clearly, if they're putting movies in the theaters in South Korea, that means that their production is back in working, unlike Hollywood and ours here in the U.S. There were a couple of articles out there too, HA, that the season finale of Walking Dead could air in July, but everything is completely, unclear. But Newsom should be either already has or will be soon putting the green light on film and television production again in California, and then it's just a matter of hammering out the details with the unions for safe working conditions.
I look forward to it whenever it comes out. I think they're going to tease it to the max until that happens, but I think, I don't know, at least what we're seeing in terms of new releases, I think there's going to be at some point, like a section of the year, just because everything's been held up, that there won't be a ton of new content. So
I'm kind of worried about that.
I think that they're already going to be kind of playing this or trying to time it to a point when it's like, there's really nothing else for anybody to watch. Maybe that's what they're trying to like maximize that.
Terrifying. What I'm hoping is that when they get to, they've already shot some of Fear the Walking Dead. They've certainly shot most of, I think, the spinoff show. They've shot enough of it to make a couple of really in-depth trailers. So all they really need to do is post on a lot of those. And then Fear the Walking Dead probably hadn't started shooting by the time all this shut down. Or if they had, they were very early stages. So, and if it takes, what did that article say with Nicotero's, like 2 to 3 weeks after they wrap an episode to get it through post and coloring and all that other stuff, I think we could get back on track pretty quickly for those TV shows anyway. I mean, that's not the whole kit and caboodle, but just because AMC is such a machine of zombie material, I think we could be a few weeks away from great new content.
Once they
turn on the gears and assuming we don't regress back into a lockdown scenario.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
Should we move on and talk about the Deadlands?
Yeah, let's talk about the Deadlands. So I do want to watch the film that this is based on, which came out in 2014. This was a 2014 action film made in New Zealand and directed by Toa Fraser. And as I said, the origin of this, I don't know how much is like similar or if they basically took themes to make this specific. I did read the sort of synopsis, but I would kind of like to watch it at some point just to see.
The synopsis doesn't really have zombies in it, as far as I could tell.
Well, they're not zombies per se. I would say it's a little bit more like evil spirits, which is what it seems to be. And, interestingly enough, I think it's a kind of the theme of the show, at least. And I think the theme of the film is a little bit similar to what we just reviewed a few weeks ago with the Blood Quantum, which is the idea that in this case, the natives of New Zealand, the Maori, are basically sort of dealing with the poisoning of the land or a sin to the land and trying to figure out how to stop that.
Are you still talking about 2014 or
2020? I think both of them have a similar theme in that from what I read, but there isn't actually a ton of news about it. But The Deadlands, yeah. the TV show, it is basically, it is 8 episodes total, correct?
Yes.
I think.
8 episodes, yep. Each one's about 45 minutes long, and they all aired in, I think, in Australia in January and February of this year. And now they're on Shudder.
You know, it's kind of interesting as I started to watch this. So there is somebody involved with this. And also I should mention that the person that also was involved in creating the film as well as the series is Glenn Standring. And so that's somebody who's been involved in both of these things. And
it's weird that they share a Wikipedia page, considering they're not. Yeah, they are a little bit tangentially connected, but it might just be that there's not a lot out there. So whoever is putting Wikipedia page together was like, these can go on the same page.
Well, it was also I was trying to find out a little bit more about, you know, the television show sort of came into being, and like maybe what they had to go through. And there isn't actually a ton out there, though. I did find a few interviews with Glenn Standring. So that's kind of, I will throw those into the show notes. There was one on Nerdist, and I think there was like a couple of other, which talks just about some of the themes of the show, and especially about the storytelling and, you know, because some of the story and the themes on this are, you know, are specifically Maori stories, and I'm, you know, and this it's like specific to their storytelling culture. So I think that would be kind of interesting to talk about as we go through this. In any case, there wasn't a ton of stuff that I really wanted, that I was hoping to find out about this, but maybe there will be more now that it's actually released.
I'm with you. I want to read all the backstory. I want to know how much of this is based on actual myth and legend.
Well, there is definitely, like, I mean, they mentioned Maui in this at some point. So there are the god Maui. So there's definitely like, there's definitely stuff in here that is based upon, I think, probably stuff. Probably authentic to like, or probably referencing specific Maori mythology. But the one thing I was going to say is that as I started to watch the show, and I did not know this before, and maybe I did and I forgot and was reminded, but I know, and this is like one of my, like, this was one of my guilty pleasures, but I used to love to watch like Hercules and Xena, Warrior Princess, and this has a little bit of that feel to it. And actually one of the people involved with this was involved with Hercules. And I don't know, is it with Xena as well, but it was just sort of the way that the flow of the story was going and some of the humor, I was like, this feels a little like that. And then I was like, oh, how funny that this guy is involved in it. I will have to find his name.
That is interesting. I've seen the odd episode or two of Xena and Hercules, but never really got into those. But I guess I can feel what you're talking about, because this is it. Let's just put it out there. This is like Greek myth. I was going back to how this was reminded me, at least, of Greek mythology and the stories that you tell about like demigods interacting with gods. And you have a whole lot of that vibe here for sure. So yes, Xena, Hercules, it's right in that wheelhouse. And I don't know if, you know, if those are just like two cultural things borrowing from one another, or if this is something that would have felt very natural in Maori storytelling too. But it is this like close-knit interaction between mortals or demigods. I'm not sure if Waka is maybe supposed to be a demigod, because he kind of feels like it that way.
He does feel like it that way, even in how Mehe treats him and talks about him, and how everybody talks about him.
He has a legend, yeah, right? Even from the first episode, they're like, oh, the legends say, and it's like, this guy isn't that old. How does he have a legend? Right,
so I think it's on us to kind of figure out a little bit more about him.
Yeah.
But his character is actually played by an actor who was in the original film, but under, I think he had a different character name, and I'm not sure if it's the same character, but renamed maybe.
Te Kohei Tuhaka?
Yeah, and he goes, I've seen...
Oh, yeah,
I
he
did...
was Wirepa in the original film. Yeah, he was a major character. Maybe a bad guy?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't watched it, so it's terrible. But he goes by, like, Takoe goes by, like, I did watch a couple of, like, I tried to find interviews with him and just couldn't. I did find one with the main person who plays, the actor who plays Meihei. Her name is
Darnene Christian.
And she is from, like, she's also from New Zealand, and this was like her first big break. And so there was a really good interview that I'll send to you, Stuart, but,
it's a huge role.
I mean, role.
If this is one of these, like, first break, but lead on a whole, you know, TV show that's internationally syndicated, it's a huge break, and she's good. She's really good in this role.
Yeah, and Takoe Tuaka was actually, apparently he has been in, he was well known obviously before this in New Zealand because he was on like a few different shows. And one of the things she talks about in this interview is how sort of starstruck she was when she realized who she was going to be opposite of. Nice. And it's a really, like, she's really, it's interesting to hear her talk about it and talk about, the town that she came from and how she basically takes her hometown, like in her origin, wherever she goes, and she wants to do them proud. And I it's really like, I'll put that in the notes because I thought it was really kind of cool to hear her talk about it. And that was one of the better interviews, to hear her talk about the show itself, because it's really sparse. And hopefully there will be more stuff out there, because I would like to learn a little bit more about the creation of this whole series.
Yeah, if there's a season two, which if you look at the comments on Shudder and just anywhere that people are talking about this show, they are all clamoring for a second season. So you and I are only two episodes in, unless you couldn't help yourself and went ahead. But it is apparently landing well with fans at this point.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's also, look, I think that the setting is obviously pretty cool.
Well, okay, yeah. You shoot something in New Zealand. We learned this in Lord of the Rings. You just put a camera anywhere, point it and hit go, and you're going to have beautiful backdrops. So that's working for them, definitely. It's got a really nice natural vibe. Also, let's talk about production. The costuming is gorgeous. Meihei has this beautiful, like, I don't know, like, combat dress on.
Yep.
Waka Nukurao wears this amazing, like, feathery shoulder thing. It just, everything feels legit. But I don't know what I'm supposed to be looking at. I don't know what is legit for Maori. I know next to nothing about Maori, right? But it just feels right. It all feels really good.
Well, at least based upon the article that they did with Nerdist, or the, you know, the sort of review, like, they went all out to try to make like an authentic story and storytelling. So I would imagine this is probably pretty things that are not, because we are not familiar with the culture, but I think that it's probably things that are authentic to the Maori culture. Though I would love to know a lot more about the significance, so I think we should talk, like, figure that, like, see if there's more out there related to the show and what they had to do in the production. As I said, I'd love to hear a lot more about how they built this world and the characters and things like that. But well, in any
another
case,
pretty cool element of this show is the patu, which are these little weapons that I shouldn't call them little weapons, but they are small. They're like the size of a ping pong paddle.
They're bigger than that. I would say they're like
basically
kind of like a
but
cricket
they're these
bat,
like sharpened
short
rock
cricket bats
paddles. Yeah, okay. I mean, cricket bats are like 3-4 feet long.
I know, but that's like when the shape of them, they're kind of flat and they, you know, but they're made of like stone. They look really kind of like hardcore weapons.
They're pretty like, I've never seen anything like them. And then I love the fact that they are so widely used and referred to, and I mean, there are some warriors who we see using different weapons, but it's almost always the baddies or have spears or something longer. Everybody else has these really short, you got to get right up close, these patus, which I think that's what they're called. I feel like this whole thing is just like an education, and so that's part of what I'm enjoying about it, is just getting to learn about a little bit at least about, like, through immersion, through about Maori culture. So that's been a lot of fun. So these two episodes, the first one is kind of, it's a lot of an introduction, really. We get to meet Waka Nuku Rao, and he's a baddie, but he's also our hero. So we've got ourselves an anti-hero situation.
Yeah, and, like, he is, I mean, he has, like, traditional, like, not just tattoos, but, like, basically etchings into his face. He is in, like, a battle dress. We see him basically in battle, but then, you know, he is, you know, I think what we think is triumphant, sort of dragging his last person in and gets taken out. And this is the first thing, like, this is one of the things that reminded me a lot of, like, the way that, you know, we watch some of these mythological, based shows, like, how they roll out, is that there is a very thin line between the mortal world and the spirit world. And so he ends up pretty quickly in what is, I don't know what this is called in Maori culture, but it's sort of like, it seems a little bit like Valhalla,
he's like Olympus. This is how you welcome your heroes. That line makes me think it's like a Valhalla sort of situation.
You know, he's a warrior. I feel like we get the sense, I mean, I got the sense initially just in terms of his, and maybe it was because the voiceover was saying, you know, and it's the voiceover, as we find out later from Mehe, basically saying, we need somebody to help us who's part monster. So you kind of get, like, negative connotations about his character, even though you don't know a ton about him other than seeing him in battle. But he ends up basically in this, in the spirit world. They do this sort of delineate it by changing the lighting. It's very desaturated. There's definitely a little bit of, like, glowiness going on. It feels a little, like, it just feels a little surreal. And it's also pretty quiet other than the screaming of these, like, this thing, and he basically has his first encounter with, like, a walker slash zombie or a demon. I'm not sure exactly what it is. And he can't kill it. And he gets rescued by a godlike character. We don't know who this person is, other than that he schools Waka about the fact that, and he's, like, taunting him too. He's sort of like, hey, your ancestors aren't gonna let you in there. You've done disservice to them. You've dishonored them, so you're not allowed in there. And he's just sort of like teasing him and goading him, and then basically says, okay, I'm gonna send you back, and if you actually pledge to do honor, maybe you can get let in again. And so that basically sets out, like, the hero's journey, or the anti-hero's journey, I guess. And it was a pretty neat, exchange and a pretty good scene, because it just sets up the whole series, basically. And what did you think about that whole interaction?
I like the fact that we keep going back to this place also, where the light is white and it's very foggy. This is clearly the realm of the gods, and we go back there with other characters. And mm-hmm. And I agree that it sets you up with this demon character that he can't kill, but that this god can control with a word, which also sets up kind of a weird precedent, at least, that we don't see again since that scene. And I do want to find out who this guy is.
Because
Waka
seems
to know him, but doesn't call him like he calls the other god who shows up, his mother.
Yep.
Or maybe she's just an ancestor and not a god. But, you know, in this culture, I'm a little bit at sea in terms of how they're relating to.
I definitely, I will admit, I definitely got the sense that we were supposed to know who the god was, and I was like, I don't quite know.
He has a Hades kind of vibe, right? I mean,
yeah, like he's definitely got that going on. He's got, like, a ferryman sort of a something happening, where, you know, he can, or an Odin vibe in terms of, like, that kind of a god, that kind of a. Like, I don't know. Like, so we'll have to figure this out and come back. And apologies for my ignorance on it. But in any case, he gets basically told this. Then he wakes up back in the real world. We kind of have him going back to wherever his home is. He seems really angry and annoyed at this whole thing that he's supposed to be doing. And it's sort of unclear whether he's going to do it. And then he immediately encounters what, but he thinks it's like his, I mean, it's his wife basically, or one of his wives. And she has become one of these creatures, and he does a good job. Like, it's pretty impressive how he manages to like tie her up and restrain her versus killing her.
This is a scene that doesn't really get resolved though. He's looking for his two wives. He ends up tying one of them to a tree, and then we never go back to her.
No.
He doesn't do a coup de grace on the one that he's captured. He doesn't find his other wife, and then they're kind of out of the story. Maybe they'll show up later, but for now it seems like that's done, and we move on to meeting Mehe, who looks like a hot mess. We have met her in a flash or another scene before before she shows up looking all muddy, and it was kind of hard to recognize her, because in her normal garb and look, she's pretty put together, and then in these scenes outside of Waka's hut, she is covered in mud, and she has seen better days.
Well, she's like camouflaging herself, and the interesting thing for Waka, I think, here is that, and he asks this a few times, is whether this is a dream or whether he is in the real world or not, because basically he's encountering the same kind of creatures that he just encountered in the spirit world. And so I think he just doesn't know which way is up or down at this point. And he's kind of like, you see this like struggle, and I think that this actor does an incredible job at sort of betraying this conflicted character, because he wants to be a jerk. He wants to do the stuff that he's kind of done before, which is we get the sense that he's just very self-serving and does whatever he wants. And then, you know, he yells at Mei, and then discounts her. And then he has to go and seek her out. Like, you see him pause because he's like, oh, I got to do something to do with honor. I guess I should go. Like, because she has asked for his help, and he has told her, like, flat out no.
It's pretty funny when he turns her down, and then he's walking through the forest talking to himself, which I do like that part of his character also.
Yep.
Turns out later he's trying to address the gods, but he's basically just talking to himself a lot in the forest. And he's like, he said no to her for her quest, and she's offered him this beautiful jade weapon, and he basically is like, nah. Then he walks into the forest. He's like, how am I supposed to find honor? There's no honor. Oh, crap. Like, you see him have the realization that, I think accepting the quest from the desperate woman
probably would have been it, right? Well, so, and it's not like she kind of hit him over the head with it. It's like, this is this weapon that I'm bringing you, this beautiful jade weapon, is, you know, the treasure of my people. Of my, like this is, you know, there isn't a question about how desperate she is. She basically says she needs his help to go and rescue her father and like help her village. And he just flat out denies her. And then he does find her in the basically hideout that he has built. And he's kind of giving her a hard time about it.
It's another funny scene where he's like, this is a good hole. I dug this hole. This is a nice hole. You can stay here.
Yeah, it's like really funny. Like the pacing of this is really great, and the humor I think is great, because there's a lot of seriousness too, but there's also a lightheartedness as well.
Especially in this first episode, I think that's kind of what they get you with. If it was all bleak and it would be hard, but because he is a comedic, he does comedy well, even though he's clearly not trying to be a funny guy.
Yeah.
There are things that he does like that, like that realization that he has to go back and accept her quest. Like when he realizes he would much rather be up in the tree with her.
Yep.
It was another very funny scene. So I enjoyed. I'm enjoying their repartee and I guess it's kind of like an arc of humiliation for Waka to an extent.
Yeah.
For being this like man of legend, kind of having to have human interactions. It's kind of fun.
But I also think that the rapport between these two actors, between TK and Darnene, are like like they have a really good, they have great chemistry. They also have a really good like comedic timing with each other, and their delivery is just like, there's some really great just sort of deadpan deliveries that I'm like, this is just phenomenal. So I'm enjoying, like even from the first episode, even, and obviously we're gonna watch the whole series, but the first episode, I feel like that was one of the big things that drew me in, was just like, I do want to see these two go on adventures together because it's probably going to be hilarious. So, but not hilarious in like a slapstick way, although there is slight like borderline of that sometimes. But it's also like they both have these challenges. The character of Mihe is, you know, she's dealing with the fact that she is clearly a talented hunter, and she is discounted, it seems, by her family. Her father is the leader of her tribe and her village, and he basically, it's weird because like, and we see like the dynamics, and again they lay this out pretty succinctly in like a very small amount of time in a small scene, but she shows up in the village to show them that something creepy happened to the bird that she hunted. They try to discount her, and she basically says, no, there's something wrong. And she gets this like line from her dad, which is just like, can you just sort of behave like you're supposed to? But also, I really respect, but I'm fearful for how smart you are. Like, there's like this weird conflict. And it's mainly because she's a woman and she's trying to be in this role that is traditionally a male role in her, with her family and her village. And
her brother's kind of a douche.
Yeah. And he's very like, he does not have the level of strength and talent that she has. And he definitely is not as smart as she is. And he's constantly, what's interesting about it though, he constantly tries to tell her what to do and she just completely ignores him, which I kind of like.
That is a nice element.
But anyway, we see what happens. We get flashbacks of what has happened with her village and why she has been seeking out Waka. And I will say, like, this is the part where, you know, she talks about like needing to find him and the legends about him, and even her initial interactions with him are kind of like, oh well, I came to find you because you're the only one that can help me do this, and admittedly nobody else in her village will stand with her.
It's, so it's kind of curious that nobody told her to go get this guy, you know, and certainly nobody told her to like take our treasure and go find Waka. Like, that's kind of the way she phrases it, I think, at the beginning. My father will do anything, you know, if you help us. But when we get the flashback, it's just like, okay, we were not expecting an attack. In that attack, my father was actually taken, and everybody else was just panicking. And as soon as, you know, next day, she's just like, all right, I'm out of here. I'm going to go. I know the plan. I know what to do. So you got to admire her tenacity and just the fact that she's very impulsive and
right,
seems to
and
make good decisions.
And she doesn't, I mean, she doesn't back down. I mean, like
she really doesn't back down.
Waka is like, he is a big dude, like, and he is clearly legendary. And she just kind of like takes his attitude in stride and doesn't take it very seriously, which I really liked that. And then one of my favorite scenes is the one you mentioned where she has told him that at night, the zombies come out, basically the spirits, these dead warriors or whatever they are, come out, that they can travel safely in the day, but at night they should probably sleep up in a tree. And he makes some comment like, oh, I'm not doing that. And
warriors,
then like,
warriors don't sleep and hide in trees or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, sheepishly ends up in the tree with her, which is pretty funny. So that was good.
Can I also just take this moment to recognize and appreciate his sleeping cloak? It looks super comfortable. It's got these little feathers on it. Yep. I love that that's part of his costuming, is this like cloak that he whips out every night. It's really cool.
Yep. I agree. And you know, it's kind of like this whole beginning sequence. This whole beginning episode is just sort of laying out what their journey is going to be, or where it will go. So, you know, they end up coming back to her village. And I mean, let's point out that her dad had been basically dragged into this hole in the earth by these warrior zombies. And she's convinced that he's still alive. Everybody's convinced that he's dead.
I mean, he should be dead. It's been 10 days, because it turns out it's a 5-day trip from Waka's land to hers, which, yeah, he should be dead.
Yeah. And so anyway, they are going to go and take care of business. She gets a lot of flack for bringing him back, which I also thought felt a little weird because nobody else is willing to help her.
This is a theme in these first two episodes, is she seems to be the one, the woman of action, and nobody else typically steps up with her. In the second episode, we do finally get an ally who hasn't been a character that we've known until episode two. And then he steps up and his dad, and well, that doesn't go for Pops. But she does have at least one ally in the tribe. And I think by the end of episode two, it feels like the tables are turning and maybe her brother's power is not going to be as much as it was.
Right. We should also mention that during their journey back to her village, Waka is having more visits into the spirit world, where he comes into contact with his mother. And this actor, I don't know if you ever saw the film Whale Rider.
No, but I'm familiar with it.
This actor that plays his mother, or this spirit or god, is named Vicky Houghton, and I really think she's amazing. And she's both hilarious and terrifying at the same time in these exchanges. So he basically is interacting with her. It's kind of unclear what's happening, and she suddenly demands that he sacrifice. And I guess is this after her dad dies? This is after he's done the...
It's right after he's been killed.
Yeah. So they've gone to rescue her father, which is, as we suspected, a futile adventure. Her dad has begged to die because he's been infected or taken over by these spirits, and she does the deed, and you can tell, like, Waka does offer to do this, but then he sees her do it herself, and you get this sense that he is impressed by the fact that she's done this, because this is what her dad asked her to do, and there is definitely a level of honor there. It's definitely in line with what we've seen in various zombie films and this specific genre, is that if you have a family member and they've asked you to do this, it's sort of like a point of honor. In any case, this is where you first see him. It appears that there's like respect growing for her. So in the next scene, when his spirit mother tells him he needs to sacrifice her, I think there is a question about what he's going to do. But I kind of, he seems so he seems to question his mother's motives. They don't have the best relationship, so I wasn't convinced that he was going to do what she asked him to do. He also seems really annoyed by the gods and them yanking him around and the spirits yanking him around, so it kind of feels like he's going to be a bit of a rebel on that point anyway. But I was very happy when he decided to obviously not do what his mother had advised and instead decides to train Meihei as a warrior.
Yeah, so obviously that's a good turn for us for the story. It's a little interesting that his mother demands that he drink her blood, and this is part of his legend also, is that he drinks the blood of people he defeats. And this is, I think, something that normal people like Meihei think is disgusting and vile, but it's kind of interesting that, like, his mother, the goddess, just says, all right, yeah, kill her and drink her blood. You're going to need her strength because you're going to face a lot of weird stuff down the road. So there's an interesting kind of duality there of, does he really drink people's blood? Is it gross? Is it bad? Or is it, like, this thing that will give him extra power, like in Ravenous?
Yeah, is this, like, part of his mythology that we just don't necessarily know that much about yet? I mean, we know it a little bit because that's what Meihei has said to him, is that she's willing to give him her life if he helps her. Yeah. And so, in some way, she has sort of volunteered to do this.
That was when she thought her dad was still alive, I think. True, I don't know if that offer is still on the table.
True, but it's, we know that she's made it and that it's there, so this seems to be like a thing that you would offer this particular character because he apparently gains strength from it. And so in any case, I think that's around where this particular one ends, correct? And they go off on their...
Yeah, they decide to meet back up with her brother, who has led their family and tribe to an uncle's, to like their nearby uncle, their father's brother's tribe. he is a powerful shaman and can protect them, I think is what Rangi is saying when they run into one another on the road. That's also a really cool interaction when, like, her whole tribe... Basically, if you love Haka, this is the show for you, because it feels like somebody's doing some version of Haka every 20 minutes, and it's awesome.
And there's also some mention that perhaps her uncle might know what's wrong with the land. And there's clearly, I mean, the fact that these warriors are coming back to life, that the animals are dying in the way that she had shown her dad at the beginning. There's definitely there three or four different people have said at this point that something is wrong with the land. And so there's some implication that her uncle might know what that is. Though we do see a bit of a dark sort of it's not it. I guess it's a flashback with her uncle, or is it present?
I think that has to be a flashback, or who knows? It's not cleared up, and it's not really cleared up through the course of this episode either. Except that we learn there was more to that scene that we didn't see. But right. that's a pretty interesting scene where there's clearly like politics as well as religious stuff going on.
But there's also, this is again in line with the whole blood sacrifice theme. We see a scene with her uncle, and there is a younger, I'm not sure exactly how old he is, but teenager, maybe early 20s, warrior who is offered to give his life, very similar to how we saw Mehe offer her life to Waka. And there is some argument about it between the uncle and other people in the tribe, and this one warrior basically says, "Why are we, the young, making up for your mistakes?" And the uncle basically says that the gods have demanded the blood of a warrior. And if that sounds familiar, then it does, because that's exactly what Waka's mother had demanded he do with Mehe.
In full bloom, also, was one of the other qualifiers.
And so instead they, of course, take out the guy who says this and accuses the shaman of this. So there is that, and we know what Waka and Mehe are walking into, which is maybe not something so great. So that sort of sets up the next episode, basically.
And there's this episode is dominated by, like, now more tribal politics, where Mehe and Rangi, which is her brother, are kind of going bumping heads. Her mother never seems to take her side, but is also just like this cool presence who doesn't seem to take Mehe's side very much, but doesn't also weigh in that often. She does seem like a respected member of the tribe. So I'm kind of curious to see how her mother's going to be developed as a character. But in this episode, she basically finds out that her husband is dead and is not doing so well with that. And a lot of the rest of this episode is about trying to get the truth out of the shaman, telling Rangi that that they went to see Mahia. I think her name was Mahia, the woman who is basically the mother of some of the young man that we saw being sacrificed at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then Rangi diming them out right away to Uncle Shaman. And then Uncle Shaman pulls a real nasty trick. And clearly, the politics here are deadly. And there's a little bit of magic going on here, too, because he clearly walks over the quicksand trap before he asks them to come and join him on the other side. I think this is a cool trap. It's cool. It's a cool story element, too.
But the interesting thing about all this, you know, and one of the things that I liked is that she and her whole family have gone here to basically be safe because he is a shaman. And they were like, oh, no, he can help take care of us. But it is apparent within the sort of interactions between her brother and whatever, like, he's like, oh, you're going to have to get married. She's like, yeah, no, I'm not. And he just has absolutely no power. Like, compared to her, he has absolutely no force of will. And so she is the one that actually is going to figure out these secrets. And it's kind of interesting the line that they walk. Like, her uncle makes comments like, I was there when you were born and I, like, dedicated you to the gods and I said that you were going to be strong, but then he'll like flip if she defies him, and when she defies him he'll flip to saying like, I told your father to be worried about you and stuff like that. So there's a lot of family politics and manipulation going on here, even up to the point where he sort of lures them into the quicksand in his magic quicksand walking ways.
Trying to remember, does her mother help her make that sleeping potion for the guard?
Yes.
She is participating in that scene.
Yeah. And she also backs her up with, like, her brother is basically like, yeah, I told him you wouldn't go for the marriage thing. And, you know, so there's no sense that, like, anybody takes her brother seriously, really. And poor even Rangi. Up to, I know, but even up to the end, like, you know, she's trying to figure things out. And, you know, Waka's kind of like, he's there and he knows things are going on, but she's definitely the Sherlock Holmes in this particular episode. And
he's also the Han Solo. He's threatening to leave.
Yep.
Because once totally they got to the shaman's cave, he's like, well, I guess I'm out of here. But then he sticks around because he sees all the politics going on and he's basically looking out for her, which you have to appreciate. She has just no end of cojones, though. Challenges her uncle to a duel with her newly found Patu. I think they're called Patus, or is it Tapu? Either way. No, Tapu means like cursed. They say that word every so often. That's what that chicken was. She gets into a knife fight with her uncle, which is super intense and rather enjoyed winning it, mostly by following the advice of her friend, whose name I don't know yet, by punching him in the junk.
Yep.
Way to take down your uncle by punching him in the junk. But of course, he was trying to kill you, so it's legit. Waka has ended up in some underground caves because he went down all the way through the quicksand. Luckily, that was a one-way trip into the caves. There's a rescue party.
Yeah, but basically we find out from the rest of the... Once she quells her uncle, we find out that this is where basically all the...
All the boys.
All the undead are. So I think his intention was that she and Waka would get killed down there. And so she's demanding everybody else to back her up, much like she had demanded before that they help her with her dad. And at least this time, Tui decides to go with her, him and his dad. But she has to, like, basically ask twice. Her brother definitely is not on board with this. And she calls them all out. And this is also sort of, like, in line with how she just became basically the leader of all of them. She's just like, okay, we can't just sit by and watch all this happen to our warriors. This is something wrong with the land. We have to solve this problem. And she's very much a leader. And she basically... like calls them out on their cowardice. She's like, since when did we just sit by and let this happen because we were scared? So it's kind of interesting. She does have her loyal follower, and
just
they go
one.
And
just
Tui and his dad.
Well,
and they,
yeah,
and they go and they
Tui's
go and
dad.
They rescue. I know, and they go and rescue Waka, though Tui's dad does not do well in this particular setting.
No, and there's a lot of baddies down there, and these are also weapon wielding undead, which is, you know, something we don't run into that much. This is so not like anything we usually talk about. Also, just the you know, these are a whole different breed of zombie, and all the rules are a little different. And so we're still learning a lot about how this is going to unfold.
Right. And you know, they rescue Waka, and then they go back to the caves where her uncle is, and she basically tells Waka, well, we're gonna ask him what's going on. And he's like, well, why would he tell you? And she's like, well, I don't know, I'm just gonna see what happens. And as it turns out, her uncle is more than happy to tell her what's been going on, that there is a boy that is being held by three witches somewhere.
This is revealed to Waka through another god.
So it's revealed to him, but then her uncle also is basically like, they need to find out where the witches are, and her uncle knows that and sends them that way because he hopes she dies, and it's pretty dangerous apparently to go to this particular area. He makes this pretty horrible thing that he was gonna like put a curse on her to like shrink her ovaries or something.
Ouch.
But basically this launches them on their
next quest,
part of the quest.
It's just quest after quest so far, which again does feel like one of those procedural Greek myth shows from the 90s.
Yeah, but I'm okay, I'm on board with that. I liked those shows, so and you know, Xena was also filmed in New Zealand, I think. So, you know, some parallels there.
Definitely. It's a really enjoyable show. I'm loving just the production, the feel for what they're getting into. And of course it has undead, and so I'm into that too.
Yeah, me too. I'm overall enjoying it, but as I said, I think I'm gonna read a little bit more about some of the background and hopefully find out, be able to dig up some more about the show itself and the creation of the show. But it's, I'm really just digging it. I'm glad that it's out there. So, and apparently, as you mentioned, it's gained some pretty good reviews. So maybe it will have more than this season.
Let's hope.
If you have any comments or watch the show and enjoyed it or just want to share with us, feel free to email us at reanimatedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can leave a comment on our website, reanimatedpodcast.com, or tweet at us at reanimatedpcast. I'd love to hear what people think about it. I hope they're watching it, because I think it's pretty cool. Any other things to add, Stuart?
That's about it. I appreciate everybody checking this out, and holler at us again next time.
Yep, and next time we'll be watching episodes 3 and 4 if you're watching along. So, until next time, ciao.
Bye.